Hello and welcome to the Code Mobile Weekly Podcast. My name is Steve Westgarth and I'm going to be your host for the next 30 minutes. The Code Mobile Weekly Podcast has been set up to explore what's currently fresh and new in mobile technology. Every week I'm going to be joined by someone who's working in this space and we're going to explore what's going on in their life and the technologies that they're using and how that's currently making an impact. This week I'm delighted to be joined by Tim Condon. Tim is an iOS developer for the BBC and is also the man behind Broken Hand. So welcome, Tim.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to have you as the first guest on the Code Mobile Weekly Podcast, so welcome. I guess that obviously the first thing to really talk to you about is you're working for the BBC,
yep.
You've also got Broken Hands.
Yep.
That's quite a lot to be balancing, isn't it?
It is quite a lot to be balancing, yeah. It's been a fun few months, the last few months, when it's been really busy, but it's been enjoyable.
And you think you're going to carry on balancing that, or do you think that there could be changes in the future, or where are you going?
Well, it's always impossible to predict the future, but currently I'm 50-50 between both, basically. So 50% of my time is BBC and 50% of my time is Broken Hands and Vapor. That translates to more than a normal week of work.
I'm sure it does.
So I'm kind of 4 days at the BBC and then probably 4 days at Broken Hands. But it's good fun and keeps me busy.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you threw in a word there, Vapor, which some people who are listening to the podcast yep. may not have heard about. We're at iOS Dev UK this week, obviously you gave a talk on that yesterday, mm-hmm. and it was brand new to quite a lot of the attendees here at the conference.
Yeah.
So for those of people who haven't heard of Vapor, I mean, what is Vapor? What's it all about?
So Vapor is a server-side framework which allows you to develop applications for the server, web apps, websites, etc., but all in Swift. So when Swift was open sourced, it was open sourced with a runtime for Linux, and obviously the majority of the world's servers are deployed on Linux. So allowing you to run your Swift applications on Linux means that you can start developing back-end servers and back-end applications in Swift. And this provides a great number of benefits. Swift is a really great language for this. It's modern, it's stable, it's secure and type safe, all the things that kind of the current popular web technologies don't really have. So things like JavaScript and PHP, there's no kind of type safety in there. Java has type safety, but it doesn't have null safety, whereas Swift, we have optionals and we can be very sure that if something's not optional, it's going to be there. And that gives you a great benefit when developing it. And it also means that you don't have to learn another language. So if you're a developer and you want to write a back-end service, whether you're a independent developer writing a small app or whether you're a big company wanting to do a full stack microservice feature, it means you can write your own back-end service without having to learn a whole nother language.
So obviously I'm a Swift developer,
yep.
So it kind of makes sense to me to mm-hmm. adopt something like Vapor, but there are a lot of other server-side technologies out there.
There are, yep.
So why would I adopt Vapor? Why is that the best option?
It's not necessarily the best option for everything. Let's kind of make that clear from the start. There are some caveats, and it won't be the right tool for all jobs. However, as the Vapor ecosystem matures and grows, it's going to take over more and more of those roles. So if you want something to spin up with a massive backend that does a million and one functions by tomorrow, definitely don't choose Vapor. Choose something like Node.js that has a very established ecosystem. But if you want to do something that's fun and you want to be able to have more control over it and you don't want to learn it, then choose Vapor. So Vapor has a number of benefits. First of all, it's Swift. And you know, that's the big benefit at the end of the day, is that you get to use a language that you love and know. You can still develop in Xcode, so all the tooling is the same. You still use Foundation, so all that is the same. But also, as I mentioned, Swift's modern. A lot of these server technologies have been around for 20, 30 years. And lots changed in that time. The world is a very different place these days, especially in technology.
And is that also a disadvantage? Because I mean, your Vapor is brand new. We're now
yep.
on Vapor 3. Is that right?
Yep,
as of this
that's
year.
Right.
So you know, it's brand new to the to developers. So is it too early to adopt?
No, I think it's at a state where it's nice and mature now. It's fairly stable, and it's feature complete. The good thing about having something at this stage is that Vapor and Swift itself has managed to take all the lessons learned from the previous technology. So Swift has taken some of the best features from other languages and integrated them whilst not bringing in all the tech debt and craft that we no longer need as developers. And Vapor has done the same. It's looked at things like Laravel and Ruby on Rails and said, well, that bit's really good. We'll have that. We don't need any of that because that's not really used these days, or it doesn't work with Swift. So being able to kind of learn from other languages' mistakes has given it an accelerated path to maturity.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, obviously, you're splitting your time with the BBC at the moment. So I take it BBC hasn't yet adopted Vapor.
Watch this space, I will say.
Okay.
I'm kind of big on Vapor, and I have, I work on the mobile team at the BBC. So at the point, currently, we are looking to do some back-end development to control our own back-end services and have more control over that. And that will probably be Vapor, although the caveat that's not really up to my decision, although I'll try very hard. And I think we're looking at it and evaluating the technology, and it will probably make sense for us. But watch this space, we'll see what happens.
Okay, now that makes sense. I think if you're introducing new technologies like this, when you've got big corporations that decide that actually they are going to adopt them, I guess it gives developers like me that are working in the indie space a little bit more faith that actually it's robust enough to go down that route.
Yeah, definitely.
So BBC are thinking about it. What other companies are using it?
So if we look at the server-side Swift ecosystem as a whole, obviously there's other frameworks as well as Vapor. So there's Kitura, which is backed by IBM. So they're a big corporate enterprise company, and they are heavily invested in it, and they have pushed Kitura and server-side Swift to big clients like ING. It's a big bank. Mercedes are running server-side Swift in production, and in Europe there's a agency called Skelpo, who are a big German development agency. There's another agency in Copenhagen and London called Nodes. And these people have got big clients, and they're running Vapor. So it has been proven in production and maturity. Vapor Cloud as well, which is kind of Vapor's production deployment system, which anyone can use to deploy Vapor to the internet. That's obviously all written in Vapor. And that gets tens of millions of requests a day.
Wow.
So it's a big, mature system, and it works.
Happy days. And obviously, if these companies are investing in it, then people will follow suit, I guess, over time. So people might be listening thinking, right, brilliant, I'm convinced I need to try Vapor, I need to get started. So if I've never heard of this before, I want to get started with the technology.
Yep.
What's my starting point? What do I do?
The best place to go would be to look at the Vapor documentation. So if you go to docs.vapor.codes, which is the documentation for the Vapor website, there's loads of stuff on there to help you get started, help you install little tools and any dependencies you need, and take you through. There's also loads of tutorials out there, some really good stuff on Medium, and there's some good talks out there as well. The talk I gave yesterday was filmed, so you can go back and watch that, and I take you through basically creating a very simple REST API in about 15 minutes.
I think the talk you did was 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So is that, if I was starting with Vapor, I mean, obviously it might take me a bit longer than 15 minutes to get up and running, but presumably it's quite a simple thing for me to get my head around as a Swift developer. I should just be able to pick it up and run.
Yeah, so Vapor's design has been very focused on providing a very Swift-like API, a very natural API for Swift and iOS developers to pick up, something that makes sense. Some of the other web frameworks out there can be a little bit confusing if you're coming not from a back-end background. And Swift has a very nice API itself, so Vapor's very much taken that to heart and decided to provide a very nice API that's easy to use and easy to understand, and hide away and provide a lot of syntactic sugar to some of the more complex stuff that you might find in other languages and frameworks.
Fantastic. Now that makes sense. And of course, you've written a book on Vapor as well.
I have written a book,
yes. You are the expert on Vapor at the moment.
I've literally written the book, yeah.
Literally written the book. So what's happened with that? I mean, that's now out and available for people to buy? Or
yes, it is. So I've written a book for raywendlick.com on Vapor. It basically takes you through everything from having no knowledge of Vapor or back-end development to over the course of about 35 chapters or so, having built up a very fully featured API that does REST and authentication. It has different types of relationships between different models in the database. It also shows you how to build a website using the templating language, which is called Leaf. And I've also written the book with Tanner, Logan, and Jonas, who are the Vapor core team. These are the guys who created Vapor, founded Vapor, and maintain it. And so they've written some chapters as well. So it is kind of the unofficial official guide on vapor.
So if you want to know anything about vapor, get the book, have a read of that, and that obviously is going to be a great starting point for a lot of people.
That was released a couple of weeks ago in full. It's been in early access for the last few months, and the first edition was released about 2 weeks ago now, and we're already working on the second edition.
Fantastic. So, I mean, obviously, you've been involved with vapor pretty much since the start, I guess.
Yeah, from probably the 0.4, 0.5 days, not long after it came out.
And I think we were talking a few weeks ago, and you mentioned that you'd started off by deciding to write a blog engine in vapor. That was sort of your main Christmas project, is that right?
Yeah.
So how did that work?
So, at the time, I'd been playing with vapor. Vapor came out in about February 2016, and I picked it up in about July or so. And I've been playing about with it on and off for the last few months and kind of doing a little Hello World projects and stuff like that, but never really get my teeth into it. And then Christmas came around and had some time off. And at the time I was using Python, PHP, JavaScript, C#, Java, Objective-C, Swift. And I thought, right, I'm fed up of trying to context switch between all these languages. I really like Swift. I've really kind of got on board with Swift and thought, right, I'm going to go all in. So I thought I'd port one of my websites over. It was a very simple website, didn't really do much, but it did have a blog. So I thought, well, I could either kind of move that to something like Medium or WordPress, but then I decided, well, I might as well try and develop a blogging engine. How difficult can it be? In the famous last words.
And I'm sure it was easier than you thought, right?
And the initial proof of concept with very basic features didn't take that long. And then I went down a rabbit hole, and about 6 months later or so, came out with something that was pretty fully featured. And at the time, there wasn't many open source projects of vapor around. There weren't many examples to look at because it was still the very early vapor 1.0 days. And it kind of became a bit of a de facto example of how to build something in vapor, which was really nice to see. And that kind of got me started into the where I am now.
So that's now available open source?
It's completely open source on GitHub, yeah. It's currently being rewritten for Vapor 3.
Fantastic.
So I've spent the last probably 6 months working on the book and video series for rowendlich.com. And now the book's out and finished. I'm kind of starting to port all my open source projects over, with SteamPress being the first one.
Fantastic. And I think that you've just mentioned that it's been rewritten for Vapor 3.
Yeah.
And one of the concerns that I guess a lot of people listening might have is that, you know, particularly when new technologies or new languages are you're fairly young, they come out with a new version and lots of things change and you've got to rewrite things.
Yeah.
So you've obviously had that experience with your blogging engine to be rewritten for Vapor 3.
Yep.
And I think you've mentioned that there was a lot of changes as we move from Vapor 2 to Vapor 3. Is that something that's going to be a problem in the future?
It shouldn't be. It should be less of a problem. So the move from Vapor 2 to Vapor 3 was a pretty significant one, where the core team decided that they wanted to lay the groundwork for the future. And the future is asynchronous, non-blocking frameworks. That is where the world will go, because it provides a number of performance benefits. It makes your code easier, safer, because you don't have to worry about threading and stuff like that. And so for Vapor 3, they basically rewrote most of the framework from the ground up with a non-blocking architecture. Just before, at the time when Vapor 3 was in beta, Apple released the Swift Neo library, which was a non-blocking event-driven I/O library by Apple, completely open source on GitHub. And so Vapor became the first big framework to adopt that, and there's still the only framework to be completely built on top of it, and that is how the future is going to go. But if we look at the development and life cycle of Swift, Vapor's following a very similar pattern. So when Swift 1 came out, it was all very new and exciting. Swift 2 came out, it started to grow and find its feet a little bit, and then Swift 3 came out when they basically looked at the last 2 years and decided, this is what's working really well. This isn't what's working really well. We need to change this. And they weren't afraid to break it. And I think for such a young technology, that's really important. If we were stuck writing Swift 1 code, it wouldn't be as good as it is. And Vapor's basically taken the same approach of saying, we're never going to design something perfectly from the get-go. We need people to try it out, see how it works in the real world. And they weren't afraid to change it. Vapor's been out now for about 2 years. And it's reached a maturity now where it is fairly stable. And I suspect when Vapor 4 comes out, it will be a very similar transition from Swift 3 to Swift 4, in that there'll be some new features, a couple of little things that need to change, but for the most part, it should be incremental. There certainly won't be any big, complete architectural changes like there were with Vapor 2 to Vapor 3.
So therefore, if people have invested in the technology, yeah, the chances are it's going to work with minimal porting to go and keep up.
And in a similar way to Swift as well, because we only saw Swift's adoption really take off when Swift 3 came out. And I think the same will happen with Vapor.
Well, that makes sense. So obviously sat here at iOS Dev UK, it would be remiss of us not to talk a little bit about the conference and what's gone on over the last couple of days. iOS Dev UK, if you haven't been to it before, is a fantastic conference. It takes place every September in Aberystwyth, which is a long way from anywhere, really, is Aberystwyth. It's many trains for most people from most places across the country. But it's well worth a visit. So there's about 200 attendees here this week. And we've had a whole range of talks. So what's been your highlight so far, Tim? Obviously excluding your own talk.
Obviously excluding my own talk. Yeah. Well, the really exciting thing for me was that I wasn't the only server-side Swift talk this year. There was another guy, Mikhail, doing another talk on server-side Swift, which was really exciting. I really enjoyed the HomeKit talk by Adam Rush this afternoon, purely from a personal point of view, because I've been fully invested into HomeKit for a while now, much to the demise of my other half. So that's been really good. There was a really interesting talk on testing and onions and layers by the Allegro guys over from Poland, and they're a very, very big app in Poland. They have a large team, very similar to how we work at the BBC, and a lot of the experiences and challenges that they've faced were exactly the same that we'd seen. So it's kind of nice to validate that.
I think that's one of the problems in the development community generally. Obviously, we have events like this where we share knowledge and practice. Mm-hmm. But you've mentioned there that their team had very similar problems to what you had at the BBC. Yeah. And it's almost like you've done double learning because you haven't been able to combine that experience.
Yeah, it is. And it's probably a matter of scale in that there are probably very few companies doing iOS development at the scale that we or Allegro or any kind of large corporation are. I mean, we have 150 mobile engineers, I guess, at the BBC. We develop 60, 70 apps on the App Store, and that's probably iOS only alone. Doesn't include Android. So we're certainly butting up against the limitations of what Apple will allow us to do. Certainly things like deploying and doing beta testing, rapidly deploying to the App Store, all these things that we have to kind of manage. I think coming to more conferences like this, coming to iOS Dev UK, other conferences like Code Mobile, is a great way to learn because there are great speakers here, people who've got a lot of experience, who can share the knowledge. And it's not just the people who are working in big companies who can learn from it. The lessons learned apply to everyone at every level, which is really good to hear about.
Definitely. I think just digging in a little bit to the testing sort of thing you were talking about, I think I've had some conversations with you and also other people who work at the BBC about your approach to testing. I know you've got, you know, the facilities to have massive test labs where you can test on thousands of devices and these sorts of things. Now you're seeing more and more, I think there's one up in Edinburgh and there's another couple of labs in the UK where you can hire out that sort of facility. But what do you think, for the indie developer that's sort of floating around, how do you improve your test coverage? How do you make sure you're releasing the best app you possibly can?
That's a very open question.
It is.
I think we're very lucky at the BBC in that we have buy-in from management and high up and senior leadership that we should create a good product rather than get a product out there, which means we can do things like test-driven development, which means we do things like exclusively pair program. So every piece of code we write is pair programmed. And being able to use that gives you a lot of benefits. So test-driven development, I think, is extremely important. We'd all love to write perfect code. We'd all love to write code that's never going to change, but that is just not going to happen. It's a fact of life. So if you write your test from the start, so the way we work at the BBC is that when we're writing a feature, we'll write tests to test the behavior of the feature at quite a high level, which means they'll exercise many classes, many objects in our test, and then we can write that behavior, but we make sure the test goes red first, so we know it fails, we then fix the test, And then we basically bank that test. So that's the red-green refactor thing that we always hear about. And then when it means that in 6 months' time we come to have to change our app, maybe want to tweak something in a completely other location, we know that we have this big test coverage that we can rely on that run relatively quickly because most of the unit tests. And it gives us that confidence that when we refactor our code and change our code, we know we're not going to break something elsewhere. So that's really important. And also looking at things like UI testing, making sure you get your apps out to users, into the hands of users. Because, I mean, we have a relatively large test team compared to most people, but we have millions of users, and there's no way that our test team can execute all the paths that 35 million people are going to execute. So making sure we do regular updates, making sure that we listen to feedback, making sure that we have a big beta test pool if possible, so we can kind of let lots of people get exposure to our apps. And then do things like small sprints, small releases. So if we're releasing every 2 weeks, the risk of change is a lot smaller, whereas if we're releasing every 6 months, you know, it's a lot bigger thing to release. And then we can just fix forward and fix fast. And I think that's a good approach to take.
Did it make sense? Happy days. So, I mean, to come back to you then, obviously, you know, we've talked a lot about all sorts of things that's happened in your life, but, you know, what's next? Where's the next big thing?
Well, I've started work on the second edition of the book.
Okay. When's that due to be released?
Probably early next year.
Early next year, okay.
I think I am doing more rounds of conferences. I'm talking at Swift Heroes in November in Turin. There's the server-side.swift conference.
I was going to mention that. Yep. Your server-side conference happens next week, is
next
that right?
Next week, yep. The 12th to the 14th of September.
Fantastic.
So me and a couple of guys from London and Berlin, or Copenhagen and Berlin, organise a number of vapor meetups. And we decided that the time was right to take it from a meetup to a full conference. We think that the ecosystem and the world is mature enough for server-side Swift conference. So we're running a conference in Berlin. We've got about 100 people coming. We've got 20 speakers, really high quality speakers, from all ranges, some really good companies coming. So that's happening. And then I think for me, it's building on Broken Hands and building on my vapor knowledge. And I've got a number of open source projects that I'm hoping to build up. Probably need a bit of love now that the book's finished. They've been discarded a little bit, but now I have some more time. I'll start working on those again and adding new features that people have requested. And then I've got a whole backlog of work of people wanting custom stuff and training as well. So I'm running a number of workshops at different conferences, and that's starting to move into going into companies to do training of vapor. So starting to see that now more and more companies are picking up. They want some kind of more professional training, some official training, rather than just reading blog posts. So that's kind of, I think that's the next thing for me, the next jump is going in and training up different developers and spreading the server-side Swift and vapor knowledge.
Fantastic. And if obviously people have been listening to this today, they've suddenly been inspired to get involved with vapor and they're thinking, I need to talk to Tim, how can they get in touch with you?
The best way to get in touch is to probably find me on Twitter. So I am 0xTim on Twitter, and that is 0x as in the number and hex, because that confuses people somewhat. Or get in touch on Vapor's Discord channel, or you can go to brokenhands.io and get in contact with me there.
Well, I hope people will. Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you today.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's been very good. I've really enjoyed that last half hour or so. Thank you also for listening to the Code Mobile Weekly podcast. It's in the name. We are going to do Code Mobile Weekly every week. Make sure you subscribe to it on iTunes. It will be available to download. It's usually going to come out on a Sunday. So do that. We'll have lots of other people that we're going to be chatting to. And if you find it useful, then please get in touch with us. You can tweet us at Code Mobile and let us know what you think. And also, if you know anybody who might be interested in coming on to the Code Mobile Weekly podcast and talking about what's going on in their life, please let me know. I'd be delighted to hear from them. But for today, thank you very much and enjoy the rest of your day.